This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock with an 11th hour warning about our planet. Climate negotiations have failed. World-renowned scientists are calling for swift action to save the world's atmosphere right now, before it's too late. David Spratt is co-author of the book Climate Code Red, The Case for Emergency Action. He's just sent out a rather frightening update, and we'll talk with him now from Australia. Hello, David.
Hi.
Well, we've just had a burst of cold and snow here in the Northern Hemisphere, and that always brings out the climate doubters, but the top scientists seem like near panic to me about this climate disruption. Can you tell us about the latest science and the prospect of global warming?
Well, I think what was interesting was that at Poznan a couple of weeks ago, there was a real push on by the scientists who, really get the big picture, saying that it was really important for there to be a post-IPCC update early next year before Copenhagen, because the IPCC report, which is now 18 months old and its cut-off point for the research was another 2 years before that, so that report is essentially 3 to 4 years old and is now so conservative as to be dangerous, and that's what a number of people like Ken Caldera and James Hansen and so on are saying. What does that mean specifically? We know that human emissions are going up faster than the worst scenarios. We know the greenhouse gases in the air are now tracking at worse than the worst, the most pessimistic scenarios of the IPCC. And then we have what's happening in the Arctic over the last 2 or 3 years, which is not dealt with at all in the IPCC report, which actually changes everything. And that's where our book started.
And, you know, it's kind of fantastic because I'm in Canada and I know lots of people in the United States. We're near that Arctic meltdown, and yet it hasn't really penetrated to the public consciousness what it means. What are the scientists saying? I mean, it took a little time to get this data together, I guess, to really figure out what it does mean.
Well, I mean, it started to happen that the IPCC said that the Arctic floating ice, which is the ice that just sits on the sea, historically averages about 3 meters in thickness, used to be an area of about 8 million square kilometres. I don't know why that compares to Canada, but it's about the size of Australia. They thought with global warming it would probably go towards the end of this century, in 100 years' time. What happened in September 2007, it actually dropped to half its usual size. It almost got there again in September 2008, even though the conditions were much cooler. So it's about half its size, but in addition it's been thinning because about two-thirds of the heat that's been coming to the Arctic hasn't actually been coming directly from the sun, it's been coming from warmer currents, which is an indirect global warming effect. So you put those two together, thinning ice in a smaller area, and it means that in summer now, and it was certainly the case 3 months ago, that 80% by volume of the Arctic ice is now being lost in summer. And the predictions are, I think it could happen next year. Certainly within the next 10 years, we will have an Arctic that is ice-free in summer, and that has just huge, huge consequences for regional warming, for climate on the west coast of the United States, for the stability of the permafrost, particularly in Siberia. So as one climate scientist says, what starts in the Arctic doesn't stop in the Arctic, and that's the really big issue.
Well, another thing that's really bothering me is how, and you mentioned this in your update, that Western governments have found trillions of dollars all of a sudden to pay off bad bets by the banks and practically nothing to deal with climate change, the real big threat. Now, I know Barack Obama, he's appointed a great science advisor in John Holdren, but what else should Obama be looking at here?
Well, I've talked about climate in the ways dealt with at the international negotiations and by the national governments I've seen. I mean, we had a change of government here 12 months ago from a very conservative government to a centre government, and they've just brought out a carbon pollution reduction scheme plan, a carbon trading plan, which will actually mean that Australia will produce more CO2 in 2020 than it does now, which has appalled everybody. I think the problem is that governments, one, are not on top of the science. they're dealing with IPCC science. They don't know what's going on in the Arctic. They probably don't know what's they don't want to know what's going on because it's more than inconvenient. Secondly, because of that, they're setting targets which are far too low. I mean, we've heard a lot of debate, even in Poznan, about the need for the Annex 1 countries, the advanced capitalist countries, to reduce their emissions by 25 to 40% by 2020 over 1990 levels. That's sort of the mantra. But that would produce temperature rises of 2.5 degrees, which would take us past several tipping points. It would probably flip the system to 4 or 5 degrees. So they're bad on targets. And I think the thing that we discovered most in writing the book is that governments want to see climate policy as something that you can negotiate or compromise about. I mean, they just see it as another political issue. We have a centralized wage fixing system in Australia where you have essentially the unions on one side and the employers on the other, and you always have a compromise down the middle. A trade-off. And governments think that on climate that you can engage in compromise and trade-offs. And as I have been fond of saying recently in Australia, is they don't understand that you can't negotiate with the laws of physics and chemistry. It's a really dumb thing to do. So in terms of what Obama should do, I think, one, he should absolutely get a latest science update. So he's got an evidence base for making decisions. He should be honest about that. He should be honest about that with the American people, because it's too late to pretend and live in fantasy land. Secondly, he's got to understand and talk about the conclusions that you draw from that. And the conclusions which James Hansen and many others are drawing is simply this. There is too much carbon in the air. Now, James Hansen says that to get the Arctic ice back, which we absolutely have to do, because if we don't, you get a 5-degree regional warming, because light reflective ice is replaced by dark heat-absorbing sea. That's happening already, which is why August temperatures in the Arctic this year were 5 degrees warmer than usual. We're already seeing that starting to happen. That will have two consequences. The first is that the ice sheet on Greenland, which is a 7-metre sea level rise, will melt. If there's no Arctic sea ice, Greenland will go. There is no way it can stay. And secondly, if you get that 5 degrees of regional warming plus a few other factors, you'll probably destabilize the permafrost, and there's double the amount of carbon in the permafrost in the air, and that would just be the end of the game for all of us. So I think he has to say, we have gone too far. There's too much up there. We have to reduce the amount of carbon in the air. We have to go for zero emissions. This is just from a scientific point of view, non-negotiable, and then you can start talking about the money.
Well, you mentioned the new Kevin Rudd government in Australia, but that's something that makes me feel a little helpless on climate, because I've been saying to myself, well, once something terrible happens and it's obviously climate change, then people will demand action. And it did happen in Australia with that decade-long drought, and the public voted for climate action, and now the government can't or won't do it. There seems to be a stall. So if politics doesn't work, what then?
Well, I think the problem is that people wanted to believe that the government would do more than it could. There's a bloke called Ken Ward, who's Deputy Director of Greenpeace in America, who says that one of the great climate delusions, particularly from the large green organisations, is to believe that climate is about policy. He says it's about power. And we've seen that the same thing here, where the large green climate advocacy organisations cuddled up to the new government, was nice to them, gave them lots of policy options, didn't try and mobilise people, didn't put real pressure on members of parliament, and we've got the result we have. I think this requires a huge mobilisation of people. If we don't inflict serious pain on politicians, they simply won't move, because they are beholden to in Australia in particular, the coal lobby, which is large and dominant in, obviously, North America, the oil lobby. We have to inflict political pain. I think the other thing, coming from the other side of politics is there are more people in business in Australia and I think around the world than in government who understand that there's no jobs and there's no profits on a dead planet. I mean, we have people here at the top of the business cycle who absolutely support us in our demand for zero emissions and the cooling of the planet and what we have called an emergency or war economy transition to a low-carbon future. And I think we need to mobilise them as well, because we know in the advanced Western countries that these governments will probably only change when business tells them to, because they run the show. And I think some effort should be put in that end as well, because it is certainly clear that business is well ahead of government in Australia.
I think that's true in America too. Increasingly, there are various movements from business, and you're right, no profits on a dead planet.
I mean, we see T. Boone Pickens, when Gore announced something, which was a wonderful thing to do, his challenge to American politicians in July about creating a 100% renewable electricity system in 10 years, which I think is absolutely consistent with the science. They had T. Boone Pickens, who's a Texas oil man, made even more money out of hedge funds, I understand, it saying, oh, I want to put billions and billions into solar energy. And that's the sort of message we have to hear as well.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the question you asked before, about money and banks, I mean, the mantra we've had all the time is, oh, look, we can't afford this. We can't afford this, we can't afford this. I mean, it was odd in Australia, because a report was done by McKinsey and Company for Australia, which I think was an offshoot of an international report they did. And for Australia, they showed that of all the emissions reductions, the first quarter, roughly, would be cost positive. That is, in the medium term, they would cost less than the savings. For example, you put hot water systems on household roofs, and the cost of that is less than the power bills that you save. So the first quarter would be cost positive. So it's always been delusionary for governments to say we can't afford this when it will save money. But I think the financial crash has shown that when there are bad bank managers who make bad and stupid decisions, the world can put trillions and trillions of dollars, I mean, it's probably, you know, going to end up being 10 trillion or something, into remedial measures. So for bad bank managers, if we can find $10 trillion, when the planet is in peril, they can't find a cent. And that, I think, is now clear to people. And it's certainly clear to the people around Barack Obama who are talking about a Green New Deal. Whether, of course, they'll deliver is another question. But I think that the people he's appointed, and the statements they're making, there are certainly signs of good intent. And I guess we'll have to wait till next year to see whether they are realised or not.
We're talking with researcher and author David Spratt from Australia about emergency action to save our climate. And I want to get back to the science for a minute, David. How credible are the new warnings about Arctic methane getting into the atmosphere?
Look, it's a bit early to tell. There was some very credible evidence given at the American Geophysical Union Conference in San Francisco last week, which is the largest gathering of climate scientists for the year. What they have detected is permafrost is permanently frozen ground. I mean, think of Siberia, think permafrost, the northern part of your country as well. There is also permanently frozen ground under the seabed. And what they're detecting is that some of that is melting, so you're getting methane bubbling up through seawater into the surface, which is disturbing. The reason for that probably is that you're getting much warmer currents up there, the sort of the warmer ocean fluxes that have melted most of the Arctic sea ice may be starting to destabilize some of that methane. What we don't know at the moment is how large the problem is presently, and what the trajectories would be. So there's no modelling of it. I mean, if a substantial amount of methane, either the land-based or the ocean-based methane, were to be warmed and to be mobilised, that would be the end of the planet as we know it for most people and most species. It is a very bad sign, but it hasn't been quantified enough yet for us to be able to say how bad, how soon.
Good enough. Well, another question that one listener asked me is, what is the climate carbon cycle? What does that mean?
Well, we have large amounts of carbon which are stored and exist in various parts of the biosphere. So the one we obviously know about is that there is carbon in the air. That's the smallest amount. There is carbon in the oceans. I mean, a cubic meter of water will hold 1,000 times apparently more water, more carbon than the same amount of air. So we have the air, we have the oceans, we have the soils. I mean, we have carbon obviously stored in the form of oil and carbon, but also organic material in soils and deeper down. And then we have the carbon which is stored in the living earth, in rainforests and trees and so on. So we have these banks of carbon, and obviously there is a circulation between them. When we burn coal or oil, we're liberating carbon from the ground and putting it into the atmosphere. There is a constant interchange between the atmosphere and the ocean year in, year out, where carbon is taken down and released. And so we can see this circulation of carbon between these various reservoirs. What's happening at the moment, of course, is that we're liberating carbon from the soil, also from living material with the destruction, particularly of rainforests in the Amazon and closer to us here in Australia, in Indonesia, and the destruction of rainforest, the trees are killed, they're burned, and the carbon pours into the air. So that's the carbon cycle.
Because I've read a paper recently called Climate Carbon Cycle Feedbacks by Andrew McIntosh and Oliver Wouldring. And one thing in it that I found really frightening was, it seemed to me they were saying, and you can correct me on this, but it seemed to me they were saying the probability of holding greenhouse gas levels at 550 parts per million was unlikely. And we might be heading towards 650 parts per million. Now, people like James...
Well, that's a dead planet.
That's a dead planet. And how can
that's
we debate whether to go there or not?
And that's a delusional bait. I mean, Sir Nicholas Stern brought down a report two years ago for United Kingdom saying, look, we should aim for 450, but it's too difficult, so we'll try for 550. The implications of the policy that the Australian government has just brought down is probably 550 to 650. I mean, this is why I call the debate delusional, because these people do not connect these abstract numbers to real lived impacts. And one of the problems we have is that as the Earth warms, we find, for example, that at less than 1 degree, we are warming the Arctic to the extent that the sea ice will go. The lack of sea ice will warm the Arctic region by 5 degrees, and that's going to be probably getting close towards enough of an increase to mobilize large amounts of permafrost carbon, which is a carbon cycle feedback. This is why we say we need emergency action. I mean, the notion that we can leave this to the market, put a price on carbon and stop runaway global warming, I think is another delusion. This is the greatest threat to mankind that we have ever experienced since we've been on this planet. I have no doubt of that. As Nicholas Stern said, that the effects would be greater than the two 20th century great wars and the depression put together. That is really on the light side. I mean, we are now facing the extinction of most life on Earth. And that's why we say we need a whole of society mobilization. This is really serious. This is not just an issue. It is the issue. I think in some ways it's the only issue. I don't know why environment organizations, from a macro point of view, bother to campaign on anything else other than climate, because if we don't get the climate solutions, all the other issues will become irrelevant. And this requires a sort of mobilization that we see in wars. I mean, we know, for example, in the year after Pearl Harbor, that the United States economy was transformed from the largest producer of consumer goods in the world to the largest producer of military goods in 12 months. Now, being a large producer of military goods in itself is not a good thing, but it just shows that if you want to transform an economy, if you want to transform an energy system, you can do it, but you can't do it in what we would call politics as normal mode.
I think that's a transformative interview. I'm going to have to leave it there. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our guest is David Spratt. He's the co-author of the book Climate Code Red, The Case for Emergency Action. It's published by Scribe Books in 2008. Be sure and visit his website at climatecodered.net. Thanks for your passion and hard work, David. Will you keep us posted?
My pleasure. And just to say, early in the new year, the book will be available in North America on Amazon as well.
Excellent. We'll look for it. Thanks again. broadcast on 16 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive. There is a whirlwind of new climate news. To help sort it out, our guest is Joseph Rome, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. During the Clinton administration, Mr. Rome was acting Assistant Secretary of Energy, responsible for energy efficiency and renewable energy. Welcome, Joe.
Howdy.
Well, your blog has so many stunning headlines. I'd like to just, maybe we could start with the new science coming from the American Geophysical Union and the Hadley Center, and then get into America's response and the new Obama administration. So I understand you were at the latest Geophysical Union conference. What's the news from there?
Well, I actually had someone reporting live from there.
Okay.
And every year the top geophysicists and climate scientists report their latest research. And they did so last week. And the basic story is that everything is melting a lot faster than people thought. Antarctica is warming and melting. Greenland and Antarctica and the glaciers have lost 2 trillion tons of ice since 2003. The Arctic is warming faster than people thought. The tundra is melting, releasing methane. So it's just, the news is the global warming is, I'm afraid, happening faster than people had feared.
I noticed, too, on your blog that the British seem to be ahead of American climate projections sometimes. I noticed the UK Tyndall Center report and then the Hadley Center. You had some graphs for your December 21st entry in climateprogress.org, your blog. And it kind of scared me. What's your reaction to this new information?
Yeah, the Hadley Center, which is run out of the Met Office, which is actually part of the Defense Department in Britain, is one of the most credible organizations in the world reporting on tracking climate and projecting climate. And, they put out this figure, which is definitely quite alarming, that, we face really what I would say is 10 degrees Fahrenheit planetary warming by the end of the century unless we get off of our, current greenhouse gas emissions path pretty soon. And, some people have been saying similar things like that. In fact, on my blog, I have been, kind of putting the case together myself. But this is the first time really that a super credible organization has said this, because 5.5 degrees centigrade or 10 degrees Fahrenheit would be a catastrophe. That is actually as much warming as the planet has seen since the last ice age, when half the planet was covered with ice. And if we had that much warming, it would eventually melt all the ice on the Earth now, and that means ultimately, sea levels a couple hundred feet higher than they are now. So, I think we can't, we can't risk going to an ice-free planet. The impacts are catastrophic.
Well, we get to James Lovelock's vision where there's a few breeding pairs of humans left up near the Arctic, where the rainforests are growing around the Arctic. We don't want that kind of planet.
Yeah, I mean, Lovelock is he makes me look optimistic. And, his is a particularly, grim vision. I'm not going to say it's impossible, but I think it is safe to say that nobody has any idea of just all the bad things that would happen if we warm the planet that much. I mean, there are models from the Hadley Center that one-third of the planet would turn into a desert. There's actually a paper that was published in Science magazine, which said that the entire southwest of the United States, from Texas to California, would turn into basically a permanent desert, a region more arid than the Oklahoma during the Dust Bowls. So, again, and it's I think it's important that people understand what the impacts are, what we would be doing to our children and grandchildren and the next 50 generations if we don't act. But one of the main points of climate progress is to lay out the technologies and strategies that exist today that can allow us to avoid that catastrophe. And I don't want to leave anyone with the impression that it's easy to do. It would take a lot of money, but we're a very rich planet. So even 1-2% of our wealth is $1-2 trillion, a year. So the bottom line is that compared to what happens if we don't take action, the cost of transforming to a green, clean energy economy is really very small.
Well, the other thing that came to me in that Hadley Center report was that it looks like if we can act quickly, that will make a huge difference as opposed to figuring, well, what will we do by 2050? Is that your take as well?
Oh, yeah. I think it's very important for people to understand that even though most of the worst impacts are in the second half of this century, what we do in the next decade will pretty much determine what path we go on. Yeah, that's because the energy infrastructure takes so long to change. I mean, cars last 20 years and coal plants last 50 years and buildings last 80 years. And it's also in part because carbon dioxide lasts a really long time. I mean, the mean lifetime of carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels in the atmosphere is 10 to 20,000 years. So you have to reverse course now and dramatically reduce emissions over the next 3 or 4 decades if you want to get on to a path that is considered to be much safer. Total warming, hopefully, of around 2 degrees centigrade, 3 to 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. That is a path that that most of the scientific community has said we need to get on.
And to get there, James Hansen's suggesting we may even have to start removing CO2 from the atmosphere.
Yeah, Hansen, who is a man that I respect more than just about any climate scientist in the world, and he has been right on this subject for 3 decades now, longer than almost anybody. He believes we actually have to reduce emissions more than a lot of other scientists, and that we're going to have to basically replace every coal plant on the planet by 2030, and may ultimately need to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, yes.
Well, I'm a little more radical than that even. I think that we're going to have to start shutting down coal plants, and people will have to use less electricity, we'll have to put in solar, we'll have to do whatever we have to do. But I'm surprised that young people aren't around protesting coal mining and the coal power plants. Greenpeace does it occasionally, but there isn't much public movement on this yet, as far as I can see.
Yeah, it's a little surprising to me that, I mean, if people understood the facts about climate change and they would be marching in the streets. I think you're going to see you're going to see more activism. I also think the good news is that as Barack Obama has appointed a cabinet that really understands both climate science and clean energy solutions. And he is going to reverse 8 years of total inaction and denial.
Well, can you tell us about some of his appointments? I mean, I'm certainly impressed with John Holdren, for example. There's a man I think we can trust there, but tell us more about the other appointments and John, if you like.
Yeah, John Holdren was named named to be science advisor, and he is a past president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He is a friend of mine. I considered him to be among the most qualified people that could possibly be appointed to the job. He is an expert both on climate science and clean energy, and he is not going to pull any punches. His appointment means that We're not going to be muzzling scientists, and we're going to be telling the American people the truth.
This is Radio EcoShock. We'll talk more with Joseph Rahm in just a few seconds. We're back with Radio EcoShock and Joe Rahm, energy expert and blogger. We're talking climate and Obama.
I'm very excited. I worked as Secretary of Energy. I worked at the Department of Energy for 5 years, and it is the agency whose job is to develop and deploy the clean energy technologies in the federal government. And the Obama picked the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Stephen Chu, who is very knowledgeable about climate, and he is an expert on clean energy and particularly energy efficiency, which often gets neglected in discussions where people focus too much on supply options. And, you know, he is a first-rate choice, but, you know, even Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State is in charge of international negotiations, and Hillary is a strong believer in climate science and clean energy, and she ran on a very strong energy and climate platform. And Secretary of Commerce Bill Richardson, normally Secretary of Commerce goes to kind of a Chamber of Commerce type, not somebody who's very enlightened on the energy and environmental matters. But obviously, Bill Richardson was Secretary of Energy when I was there, and he is a leader in clean energy. So yeah, I mean, and Carol Browner has been, you know, EPA administrator during the entire Clinton administration, the longest serving EPA administrator, someone I know pretty well. She, very strong believer in action on global warming, and, you know, I expect her to be given this, she's been named for this unique new position where she's going to oversee from the White House climate action, and she's going to be kind of an energy and climate, they've said czar, but, you know, run an interagency council that will oversee everything. So I think that the whole team is the greenest, most scientifically informed cabinet that we've ever had.
Well, a couple of things worry me about the progress with the new administration. One is I've heard more about new road building, which feels to me the wrong direction, kind of a 1930s echo, but that isn't where we're at now. We need trains if we need anything. And I'm also wondering whether Mr. Paulson and Mr. Bush haven't really drained the Treasury so dry that there won't be the funding we need to make the big energy change. What are your thoughts there?
Well, you know, first, Obama has said that a large portion of the economic stimulus plan that he has announced is going to pass quickly after becoming president will be green. It will focus on renewable energy, on energy efficiency, on energy infrastructure. So there'll be some road building and bridge building, but that is inevitable when you want to create an economic stimulus. You have to build, get money out that can be delivered quickly. But I think this is going to be the greenest economic stimulus program the country has ever seen. It will probably be $800 billion or more. And I think that, there's no question that President Bush has, ruined the car, he's trashed the place, and Obama has got to clean up the mess. Will there be less money? I don't know. I think there's a recognition that we need to spend whatever we can to get out of this mess. But the cabinet appointments make it very clear that clean energy and climate action is going to be one of Obama's top priorities. There are simply too many people who have personally staked their reputations on talking about the seriousness of the climate problem and on the availability of clean technology now. So I don't think people should worry. I mean, you keep hearing this talk that he's appointed moderates and pragmatists. I tried to do a post on that. These guys are pragmatists. They're radical pragmatists. They're pragmatists in that they believe science and understand that science says you know, as Obama says, we need to do, you know, he said, I think, science, the facts demand bold action. So, you know, you can call them moderates or pragmatists if you want. That, in my mind, just means that they believe scientists and know, understand science, and will do whatever it takes to preserve the health and well-being of this country and its next generation and a generation after that, which is precisely what we elected them for.
Well, as we wrap up, is there something else you want to tell our listeners? You have the floor.
Well, I think that I just urge people to become informed on this issue. I think that global warming and clean energy are going to be the issues that increasingly dominate all of our lives this century. And the next decade, we will engage more. But by the 2020s and the 2030s, every aspect of life in this country will be driven by an effort to prevent catastrophe. And, you know, as Holdren likes to say, you know, we have to work hard to avoid the things that we can't adapt to and adapt to the things that we can't avoid. And I think the public has taken a huge step by electing Barack Obama, but everybody is going to need to stay engaged on this issue.
Our guest has been Joseph Rohm, spelled R-O-M-M. He's the author of Hell and High Water, Global Warming, The Solution, The Politics, and What You Should Do. His blog is required reading, in my opinion, at climateprogress.org. Joe, it's been great having you on Radio EcoShop. I hope we can have you back again soon.
Anytime.
And while they celebrated, their world was beginning to fall apart. Morgan's bankers could no longer stem the tide. It was like trying to stop Niagara Falls. Everyone wanted to sell.
You and I are headed into tough times. I don't need to tell you that. The economy is crashing exactly as the climate becomes more and more unstable. This year, my wife and I will put away a little money for our old age, but I wonder if I'll ever see it again. Will savings be wiped out in a bank crash, stolen by some white-collar crook, or just come out worth a tenth of what it was due to inflation? As the economic gloom gathers, we'll also be investing in a few tools for tough times, and that's what I want to talk to you about today. Unlike many of the web dreamers, I've slogged through peasanthood in the country trying to feed a family. It ain't easy, and you need a couple of simple helpers. This is my list of must-have tools to take you through any depression or just a temporary breakdown of the system. Those little times of trouble could be from an earthquake, a climate-induced storm, a terrorist attack, riots, or global flu, I don't know, but I think the most likely cause will be the greed of the former capitalist system. You know, no money. I'll go through the list fairly quickly. You can download a copy of this radio program from ecoshock.org or get the checklist free as a printable text file from the same site, ecoshock.org. For now, just picture what you have, don't have, and what goes into your own collection. Number one, you need the ability to walk 5 miles every day. Your body is the most important tool. Except for the obviously disabled, everyone should be able to walk a reasonable distance, say to a food store and back with a small pack on you, or a temporary job you've just found, or school. The only way to prepare is to train. You know, actually get out and walk at least a mile a day. It'll cure almost anything that ails you, and no, you are not too busy to do that. Turn off the TV. It's sad to think of the number of overfed people who will be stranded when gas goes back up or runs out or a job gets lost. That means footwear that works. Fashionistas have drowned out the real meaning of shoes and boots. They're not consumer items. They're supposed to get you there upright with feet that aren't sore. Color and logos are not a factor. Lots of folks have closets full of decorative shoes and not a pair that can go 5 miles a day for 3 years. Remember, right now your shoes are made by underpaid workers in Indonesia or somewhere and brought over by ship. Some of those factories are closing down and the shipping industry is in the tank. Once the current stock of ridiculously underpriced junk is gone, shoes could be much more expensive. Good shoes may be harder to find. I waited for 2 months for the price to drop on ones I was looking at, and then I bought an extra pair for the future. They'll come out of the closet once my current ones wear out. One thing people dreamed about during the Great Depression was having a decent pair of shoes. They wished they'd bought those basics when times were good back in 1929. To get groceries and other supplies around, most of us will need backpacks, just like the college students. If you're older, consider a backpack properly designed to shift the weight to your hips. The Obus people make one that has a slanted bottom to the sack, which brings all the weight in instead of putting your back out. They added a couple of small clipped belts to hold the padded straps on your shoulders so you don't feel tense trying to stop them from sliding off all the time. Mine cost $14 on sale, and it's become a constant companion when I'm getting about on transit or on foot. More serious worriers should also get a pack frame. This is just an aluminum frame attached to a well-padded wide shoulder straps. It has an equally wide belt around your waist and an optional tump strap that goes around your forehead. Usually you can get an optional big carry bag to go on it as well. The pack frame can be used for 5-gallon water jugs when your city water goes down, or a gas can if needed. You can use it without the bag for firewood, or with the bag as a bug-out bag to get yourself out of Dodge if the situation gets ugly. You may have to walk out. In any event, a pack frame is a useful tool, even if things recover. Let's talk the really exotic tools, like rope, twine, and chain. If you have ever lived in the country, you know these are some of your three best friends. I like one piece of really heavy rope, a couple of inches thick and 10 or 12 feet long. You can tow out vehicles, pull down big branches, hang heavy things with it, maybe to keep the animals out of your food. Then add at least 25 feet of half-inch rope. 50 feet would be better. This can hang tarps, laundry to dry, tie down stuff, a million uses. The chain is for security, to keep your gear from walking away with somebody else. It can also be used to tow vehicles and haul down trees and so on. Chain is expensive these days, but great to have. All your rope and chain could go in a couple of plastic buckets. You should have at least 5 5-gallon plastic buckets with lids in your emergency supplies. Good for water, storing grain against rodents, all sorts of things. You can more than double your own strength when you add a winch or double pulley device to the rope or chain. My favorite is called a come-along, a fairly light hand winch with wire and hooks on either end. You pull the handle, that's lever power, and the gears in the winch add more force for you, holding on with each inch you gain. It can fit in a decent-sized toolbox, and you'll never regret having one. Usually, they're under $35. The double pulley is more exotic and only works with rope. People have used them since ancient times to increase the amount they can lift, move, or pull. Look into it. Let's talk about cooking and keeping warm. You may have stored a lot of food, but most of it needs cooking. Will you have money for the utilities? Will electricity skyrocket in cost? Will a storm knock out the power? The first fallback for cooking is propane. In the backcountry where we were snowed in all winter, we had a 250-pound capacity propane tank. It's called a pig. Realistically, the modern homeowner will have to settle for a couple of 20-pound propane tanks. Even a condo patio allows that, and it should get you through at least 1 month's worth of cooking, even two, if you use some of the tips I'm going to give you right now. Trying to cook rice or boiling anything on a barbecue is a useless waste of time and energy. It takes forever and a lot of gas. Plunk out $50 for a Coleman-type propane cook stove with the hose that hooks up to a 20-pound propane tank. Maybe get two hoses, as they are the weak link in the propane system, occasionally flaming out harmlessly. You keep the cook stove inside for security, but never cook inside. Head out to the patio, balcony, or the nearest park for cooking. Inside propane cooking is just too dangerous for many reasons. Don't forget to chain down your propane tanks so they don't take a walk involuntarily. Keep the tanks full. I once managed to cook for 2 months on one 20-pound tank. First of all, I tried to eat as much raw food as possible. When cooking is required, a pressure cooker cuts the time and energy used by at least 50%, and often much more than that. A stew that takes 2 hours in a pot takes about 15 minutes in a pressure cooker, including the meat and potatoes. Imagine the energy you can save that way. Save more by cooking at least two meals. If electricity is available, store away the rest in the freezer, but you'll be safer to can it in mason jars. They don't need power. Or stick the extra in a couple of wide-mouthed thermos bottles. Wrap a blanket or rag around the thermos bottles, and you'll have a reasonably hot meal tomorrow without cooking again or using more propane. Add that to your tools for tough times list, at least one thermos for hot drinks and one wide-mouthed bottle for each person in your family. A hot drink can literally save your life. There are other ways to extend heating or cooling. Of course, everyone should have a camping cooler. The $25 variety works well. If you have the bucks, the newer Super Coleman cooler keeps ice up to 3 days due to a better seal and insulation system. But the cheap one gets used here a lot, and not just in summer. You can also buy a cooler/heater that uses very low energy, about 4 amperes per hour. That means it could be powered, just barely, by a 50-watt solar panel. At the edge of the tropics, say in southern Baja, a 50-watt solar panel will put out 4 amps at about 13 volts. Watts are computed by the voltage times the amperage, the strength of the current. So 4 amps at 13 volts equals about 50 watts. Long story short, my solar panel kept this little space-age cooler going during the heat of the day, lowering the temperature by about 45 degrees from the outside. It was 90 degrees out and 45 degrees in the cooler, perfect for keeping vegetables and even good enough to save milk a little longer. The same device will also warm food, but not cook it. Beyond cooking, you want to keep warm in an emergency in colder days. That's bad news for most city dwellers. If the power goes out for more than 3 days, you are probably going to have to move out unless you can A. drain all the water from your pipes, which will freeze and flood, and B. you have some place to safely burn wood. Yes, I know there is a propane heater approved for indoor use in the United States called the Big Buddy. But look at the specs. A 20-pound propane tank will only heat one room for 3 or 4 days at the most, and the tank has to be magically outside your home, never inside it. You would need to drill through a backup propane line ahead of time, and the gas won't last long.
It might make you a bit dizzy if you bring too much of it in, but we do try to limit that, obviously.
Most natural gas furnaces won't run without the electric fan to move the air around, so if your power goes out, or you can't afford the newly inflated electricity bills, you don't have heat. If you have a fireplace or a wood stove, you might just get by for a lot longer, depending on accessible firewood. If not, one of your long-term plans might be to move to a place with some kind of wood heating option, or a place that never gets very cold, like Hawaii. Most urbanites have little idea how to gather wood. Here is a survival skill you will need to start working on right now, one I learned the hard way. It's nice to be able to identify trees by their leaves, but in winter, you will need to judge the tree by its bark and shape alone. Make a note to investigate and learn tree bark identification. That's because some trees are absolutely useless when you cut them down green in dire circumstances. Super wet wood just puts out your fire instead of heating you. All wood burns better when seasoned. I have a stack cut last year, ready to burn this year or next. But in an emergency, some trees will burn right away and others not. For example, stay away from most trees around a bog or river. To maintain their inner ecology, most of these soak up a lot of water to stay balanced with the wet soil around them. Hemlock and black ash come to mind. Fire-killing wood, even when seasoned for a whole year. Trees growing further upland are likely drier inside. All the softwoods, pines, firs, and spruce, they can be burned right off the stump. But they go quick, meaning you will need more work to gather and haul, a bigger pile, and staying up night feeding the fire. Hardwoods create the long-lasting fires and coals that keep on working for you. Dead hardwood trees still standing on the stump are the best emergency firewood of all, and you do less damage to living nature when selecting those first. You need a few basic tools for wood heat. Remember, you may end up going out of town in an emergency where the campfire is your heat and cooking source. The required tools are a swede saw, an axe, and a hatchet. Fire tongs and fire-safe asbestos gloves are handy add-ons. Go for a quality axe with a good handle. Maybe a couple of extra swede saw blades. The saw, axe, and hatchet are light enough, you could carry them out with you on your big pack frame if you must. If you have the money, a gas-powered chainsaw can bring in a winter's worth of wood in just a couple of weeks. But you need to have the gas stored as well. Make sure you have a chainsaw file to sharpen it. And don't depend on anything that needs gas in the long run. Well now, to cook over a fire, you can hang a pot from three wood poles with your chain. You remembered the chain. If you are cooking over the fireplace at home, try and find a cast iron frying pan, kettle, and pot. Your regular kitchen pans and pots have handles that will melt in the fire. Often you can find the cast iron ones, well, as used items. Another short-term alternative is the cheap camping metal cook sets. One luxury item would be an old-fashioned Dutch oven. This is just a hardy metal box with doors on the front and a handle on top. You can bake bread in them, over a fire, or even on a wood heater. You'll also need a fire-safe temperature gauge. I'm Alex Smith. We're reviewing some handy tools for tough times, like work gloves for your hands. Most of us have a callus on our mouse finger and soft hands everywhere else. The first day of hard work in a garden or wood gathering will bring out sores, unless you have a few pairs of these leather palm and finger work gloves to get you through. They are fairly cheap and a great investment. Good in winter, too, if that's all there is. The hot weather can be just as deadly, especially with climate change. In fact, heat kills more people in the United States than handguns ever do. With the ozone hole still growing, you also need lots of sunscreen. Unfortunately, this stuff only keeps 2 to 3 years at most. After that, the active chemicals break down. Still, put some away. Add 2 pairs of sunglasses with UV protection for your eyes. Everyone needs a couple of sun hats. If you are forced from your home, the tarpaulin may be your best friend. I have one large tarp, big enough to be a roof when slung over a pole, hung from trees, and one small one that fits in a backpack. It can cover you when sleeping to keep off the sun, rain, or snow. Tarps can also become walls for privacy if you are in an emergency shelter or temporary camp. You need rope. Remember the rope? To tie down the tarps. I also like to have at least 4 bungee cords, those stretchy things with hooks at either end. These can keep the tarp tight in the wind or tie kindling to your back frame. 1,000 uses. If you are just tuning in, you can download this Radio EcoShock program, Tools for Tough Times, as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org, or as a handy text file list ready for you to check off. Well, there will be light, even when the power goes out. Number one tool is a headlamp with an LED bulb. These save a lot of energy because the LEDs are so efficient and because you are just lighting the area you need to see right in front of your eyes. Cool surfers use them to wash up their dishes at night. Add some battery-free flashlights, too. I have 2 kinds. One winds up and shines. The other shines when you shake it for a minute or two. Well-made ones can provide light for years without batteries. For emergencies, I've also been impressed with the new multiple LED lights that use a few AA batteries. Some give off 100 watts of light, pretty bright, for 3 months. Good for a living room or a storage room that has no power. Of course, pocket flashlights with batteries and boxes of candles are in my Tough Times kit as well. You may need to grow some of your own food. Being totally self-sufficient takes years of practice and setup, but you could at least supplement some crummy government handouts with your own homegrown veggies. All you need is a shovel, a rake, and a hoe, plus some packets of garden seeds. Actually, I like 2 shovels. One is the long-handled pointed one, and it's good for row preparation without bending all the time. And then one of those flat-edged short garden shovels for getting at the weeds, tossing the soil, and so on. If you can only afford one, get the long-handled pointed shovel. Balcony growers will need some plastic pots and lightweight perlite growing soil. Regular soil gets way too heavy when wet and may risk breaking off the water seal on your balcony or the whole thing altogether. Perlite has those little white styrofoam spacers that help the roots find air but don't add weight. All pots need drainage holes. Figure out what sun you have and plan accordingly. Lettuce and peas can tolerate lots of shade, while peppers need sun. Read up on it. Try it out this year when you don't need it, so you will know what you are doing next year when you might. That's probably more than you can stand for this week. Another time we'll discuss medications, barter items, knives, and security. I'm Alex Smith. grab this program and the Tools for Tough Times checklist from our website, ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. And good luck in these coming tough times. This is Alex, and I'm going to leave you with some homework. The sudden economic downturn leaves us with two new pressing problems facing the world's climate and all living species. Question 1. Will the developing depression slow the growth of human-induced greenhouse gas emissions? Because so many factories shut down. Because so many fewer miles are driven already in the United States. Because people cut back on consumer luxuries. Could the economic crisis unknowingly give us an extra year or two and the motivation to change away from deadly carbon energy systems? Question 2. Will the same collapse of the economy trigger a sudden rise in temperature as factories pollute less? That lowers the layer of pollution reflecting some of the sun's energy in a phenomenon known as global dimming. In a minute, I'll play you a quote from Sir James Lovelock explaining the rapidity of human-made climate change and the hairy risk of a sudden cutback of pollution. But first, if you have ideas of guests who could answer these two critical questions, send your suggestions to me. The email address is radio@ecoshock.org. These problems may be insoluble. Who is tracking the reduction of carbon brought on by the economic collapse? Who is measuring, on a week-by-week basis, sudden changes in particle pollution of the atmosphere? Possibly no one, and yet our survival as a civilization and as a species may hang on the answers. Here is the clip of Gaia inventor James Lovelock speaking to the Royal Society in Britain on October 29, 2007.
The long-term history of the Earth suggests the existence of hot and cold stable states, what the geologists often refer to as the greenhouses and the ice houses. The best-known hothouse occurred 55 million years ago at the beginning of the Eocene period. In that event, between 1 and 2 teratons of carbon dioxide were released into the air by a geological accident. Putting this much carbon dioxide in the air caused the temperatures of the Arctic and temperate regions to rise about 8 degrees Celsius and the tropics 5 degrees. And it took about 200,000 years for conditions to return to their previous state. In the 20th century, we injected about half that much CO2, and we and the Earth itself now look soon likely to release more than a teraton of CO2. Global heating, 55 million years ago, took place much more slowly than now. The injection of gaseous carbon compounds into the atmosphere may have taken place over a period as long as 10,000 years, instead of about 200 as we are now doing. The great rapidity with which we are adding carbon gases to the air is as damaging in some ways as the quantity. The rapidity of the pollution gives the Earth system little time to adjust, and this is particularly important for ocean ecosystems. The rapid accumulation of carbon dioxide in the surface water is making them too acid for shell-forming organisms. This did not appear to happen during the Eocene event because there was time then for the mixing in of the more alkaline, deeper waters to neutralize the surface ocean. There are other differences, of course, between the Earth 55 million years ago and now. The sun was 0.5% cooler, and there's no agriculture anywhere, so that natural vegetation was free to regulate the climate. Another difference was that the world then was not experiencing that strange phenomenon, global dimming. The 2 to 3 degrees of global cooling caused by the atmospheric aerosol from man-made pollution. The haze from it covers most of the northern hemisphere and offsets global heating by reflecting sunlight, and more importantly, by nucleating clouds that reflect even more sunlight. The aerosol particles of the haze persist in the air for only a few weeks, whereas carbon dioxide persists for 50 to 100 years. So that any economic downturn or planned cutback in fossil fuel use, which lessened the aerosol density, would intensify the heating. And if there were a 100% cut in fossil fuel combustion, it might get considerably hotter, not cooler. And this is why I sometimes say I think we live in a fool's climate. We're damned if we continue to burn fuel and damned if we stop too suddenly.
That was James Lovelock. In an upcoming Radio EcoShock show, we'll try to tackle the problem of global dimming after the economic collapse. After all, as Lovelock warns, we have been protected from the worst of climate change by a thin coating of particles in the atmosphere. This wisp of industrial smoke could disappear in weeks, leading to a sudden heating of the world. Will the summer of 2009 or the following winter reach high heat records due to the malfeasance on Wall Street? The butterfly effect. Thank you for listening. I'm Alex Smith. Check out our website for past shows and our podcast. It's all free for the sake of the planet. Adios, muchachos.